Hi, Bomb Squad. You're listening to Radio Cherry Bomb, and I'm your host, Carrie Diamond. Radio Cherry Bomb is the number one female-focused food podcast in the country. Each week, we talk to the most inspiring women in and around the world of food. Let's thank our sponsor, Hanson Brook Farm Organic Pasture-Raised Eggs. Hanson Brook Farm's secret to making rich, flavorful eggs is simple. The most possible space, the best possible feed, and lots of love. It's a healthy and humane recipe that makes your omelets, cakes, custards, and everything in between taste better. For more on Hanson Brook Farm and where to find their eggs, visit hansonbrookfarm.com. Some housekeeping. Our Jubilee Conference is taking place on Sunday, April 7th at the Brooklyn Expo here in New York. If you're a new listener, you might not know what Jubilee is all about. So I will tell you. It's a conference we launched in 2014 after reading an article on Eater.com about how female chefs were being left out of food conferences around the globe. You might not remember this, but it was a very bro-y time in the food world. Anyway, we decided to host our very own conference, and Jubilee was born. It's become a real who's who of women in food, and past speakers have included Alice Waters, Dominique Krenn, Padma Lakshmi, Ina Garten, Martha Stewart, Samin Nosrat, and Nigella Lawson, who was last year's keynote speaker. We're working on an amazing lineup for you this year. Tickets are available at cherrybomb.com and cost $280, not including taxes and fees. In addition to all the great talks and panels, we have breakfast, lunch, lots of snacks, coffee and tea all day long, a cocktail party, book signings, and more. This year, we've added a VIP option, so if you'd like to splurge a little, be sure to check that out. You get everything from priority seating to a concierge shipping service for all those signed books you might pick up. Again, check out cherrybomb.com. We hope to see you at this year's Jubilee. So let's talk about today's show. As you know, we don't interview very many guys on Radio Cherry Bomb, but we couldn't pass up the opportunity to talk with today's guest, Jamie Oliver. He's way more than a celebrity chef. He's a philanthropist and a dad whose passion is helping everyone eat healthier, especially children. Jamie shares some news about what he's doing in this area and how he's transforming his organization to match his mission. We also chat about his fab new cookbook, Five Ingredients, Quick and Easy Food. If you're determined to cook more for yourself and your loved ones this year, this is a terrific book to pick up. It's beautifully designed and super practical. You'll be amazed at how much you can do with five ingredients plus some salt, pepper, and olive oil. Jamie also talks to us about his time at the River Cafe in London, working for the legendary chefs Ruth Rogers and Rose Gray. I hope you enjoy our conversation. At the end of the show, I have a short tribute to one of my favorite family members, so please stay tuned. Before we get to my interview with Jamie, we have a word from Hanson Brook Farm Organic Pasture-Raised Eggs. Hanson Brook Farm believes that organic and pastured is the way to go when it comes to eggs. Pasture-raised means better lives for hens, better lives for small farmers, and better eggs for you. It's also better for chefs who depend on rich, flavorful eggs. Hanson Brook Farm's own flock of amazing chefs, their mother hens, count on it. Inat Admini is a mother hen. She's also the celebrated chef behind Taim, Balabusta, and Kish Kash in Manhattan. Want to learn how Chef Inat whips up a mini herb omelet with cilantro, parsley, and turmeric at home? Or maybe you'd like to make her red shakshuka, an aromatic, spicy tomato sauce into which she nestles eggs and lets them poach to perfection. You can find Chef Inat's Middle Eastern egg-centric recipes and videos on hansonbrookfarm.com. And you can find Hanson Brook Farm organic pasture-raised eggs at Publix, Kroger, Sprouts Farmers Market, Fresh Direct, and many natural food stores across the country. Welcome back, Bomb Squad. Here's my chat with Jamie Oliver. First thing we wanted to know is, how are things with the foundation?
The foundation is an interesting time, actually, in a really positive way. I have run the charity and foundation for 16 years, just over, and I'm shelving it. Winding things down for a few reasons. I've decided for me personally that I'm not that into charity. The structure of it, I mean, of course I like charity, it's a beautiful thing, but I think there's a cap to its effectiveness, and there's lots of problems that have reoccurred around the operation of it and the soul of it, and I've struggled to take the values of my charity and put it across all my other businesses, almost like it was like a kind of cute, nice friend on the side. And it really annoyed me. And I think I got to the age of 40 and I'm like, I just don't want to do this anymore. So actually what we're doing is something better, much, much better. I think we've spring cleaned all of our businesses and we're doing much less, but just the stuff we're really, really good at. We're basically sort of going through the sort of version of becoming a B Corp, which is the best kind of thing that we can see out there that sort of makes you like a kind of social impact business, and we'll probably become a B Corp. That's not the main drive. And what we want to do is put values and impact in a positive way across every part of the business. And I get fed up with some parts doing it and not doing it, so let's just bake it in. So what we're doing is we've just hired a new CEO, and myself and another funder has funded something called the 2030 Project until 2030. And we're building a really robust, convincing board together, and it's audacious. And what it is, we're creating, we're kind of taking the stuff out of our campaigns department, which is really something that works every single day that no one ever hears about, which is the letter writing and the campaigns, and they would have seen the documentaries and things like that, but the stuff that created the sugary drinks tax in the UK, which has worked like you wouldn't believe. Symbolically it's worked, but actually it's worked. Two out of three drinks has reformulated. This is like hundreds of millions of calories out, empty calories out of the ecosystem in Britain. It's affected other parts of the food industry, like, you know, knowing that, you know, they've been put on the naughty step. The cash raised from the tax has been ring fenced, and I fought for that hard. And that's only being spent on sports and breakfast clubs in the UK. You know, there's like a myriad of things that we're doing, but how can I try and tell you about it the new foundation that we're setting up? It's called the 2030 Project. Its design is to halve childhood obesity by 2030 in Britain. By default, by the manner that we work, it is a global thing as well, I promise. But we need to get that international capacity by doing stuff in the UK and saying, we did it, smelt it, felt it, have a look. And we've already got loads of that happening and proof, which is so exciting. And what's really interesting is it's actually become, and I mean this, I promise, not in a worthy way, being Jamie Oliver in the old businesses, let alone the sort of leaner versions now, it's quite hard. They're always asking me about my opinion. What do I think? Yes, it's about me and I should know about me, but I'm just getting asked all the time. And sometimes I have my own internal ego arguments and commercial arguments, should I, shouldn't I, you know, cash, glamour, this, that, you know, whatever. And I mean, and so I don't even know if I'm being honest to myself sometimes, even though I think I'm pretty straight up most of the time. So what I've found and what I've done is I've given my opinion making and my decision making, not my opinion making, my decision making to 2030. It's been the most, for me, it's literally like 40% of my stress is gone.
Wow.
Right. So what does that mean? It means that if you were anyone in the world asking me to do something, I wouldn't ask me, would I do it? I ask it. And it is the 2030 Project designed to halve childhood obesity by 2030. If it doesn't somehow get or contribute to engaging people about food, getting people to try something new, give them access to information or food or something to do with food, then I ain't doing it.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
But also on the flip side, and possibly controversially, 2030 has no room for being an egomaniac or worthy or sitting around in a nice cute little place in a nice little cute postcode doing cute things for that cute location. Mm-hmm. It has to be for everyone. So it also means that I have to, if it's the right thing for 2030, I also have to work with people I might not want to work with. So I'm engaged in a couple of things at the moment, which may or may not happen, which I don't necessarily like, but if they can deliver what 2030 requires, I will technically have to do. So it's a weird master, mm-hmm. and people are probably listening to this thinking, what the bloody hell is he talking about? But for Jamie Oliver, it's a revolution.
Yeah. Well, congratulations. Revelation. You seem really excited about it.
It feels like freedom.
Yeah.
I don't think it will not come without its complexity, but also my life has always been complex. And for any of your listeners that might not understand, it's like when you have an opinion and when you've driven campaigns, you know, like, and we have done this for 15 years, life is very, very bumpy. And it doesn't mean that I'm not, I get my fair share of love and admiration and hugs and I feel like happy walking around streets and towns. But it also means that the ones that don't like you are like, it's like Marmite or Vegemite or whatever you call it over here. Like, they hate you. So it feels good.
Yeah. Let's jump to the book.
Yeah.
So, 5 ingredients, quick and easy food. What is it about today that you thought everybody needed a book like this?
Well, I think half of the books I write are solving problems that the public are telling me they're having. And over the years, I've tried to address the ones at the top of the hierarchy. And that's subjective because it depends where you are and what's happening in the country, I suppose. But we've looked at speed and we've looked at cost and we've looked at nutrition and we've looked at even emotional things like comfort food. But this is the big one. And I know that because the book's gone nuts, like books shouldn't and don't do. You know, it's gone ballistic. And the thing is, you can't fake a book sale. It is what it is. It's not a like or a kind of view. It's like a book sale. And it means that, the success of it means that it's talking to people in a way that is speaking to busy people that love food, that maybe want to do better. And my intention in its design was to edit as many reasons to not cook away so you don't get a takeaway.
Mm-hmm.
So I think and I think with maybe age or I think simplicity is easier said than done. So the idea is, as you flip through the book, my guess was more times out of 10 than not, you've probably got 3 of the 5 ingredients in your house right now. I wrote the book pretty much in a supermarket, so I wasn't kind of getting like too sort of foodie. There's a couple of things in there like miso that, papers try and take the mickey about. But my job also is to have a little dangle of aspiration in every book because that's my job. Because guess what happens, guys? The supermarkets stock it all and everyone starts trying it.
Right.
And things 20 years ago that weren't normal are beyond every day now. They were telling me in 20 years ago not to put balsamic vinegar in, and that's 2 a penny, and sun-dried tomatoes 2 a penny. So I think like what's interesting is that one of the biggest reasons to not cook was just 13 recipes. Do you know what I mean? And it's sort of like, here on this one I'm using a pouch of lentils, and if you look at not so much lentils, but certainly those pulses, they need to often be soaked for 24 hours, cooked maybe for 40 minutes, ideally an hour and a half or longer, slowly, slowly, so they don't burst.
Mm-hmm.
So like people are like, as a chef, you feel like a bit of an idiot using a pouch or a jar of curry paste, but actually curry paste are wicked. It's not curry sauce, it's curry paste. And historically, it's normal. Pesto, Thai green curry paste, mango chutneys, one ingredient that obviously has many maybe ingredients, but also fermented things, black bean sauces or misos, stuff that has like dynamism or umami or whatever you want to talk about. So I think the design of the book was to give a lot for a little.
Tell me about the 5 ingredient pantry, because that's pretty genius.
Well, the pantry of the 5 ingredients, just salt, pepper, oil and vinegar. And I felt that was appropriate to have that. I think everyone has that.
And you get so overwhelmed. We had a funny conversation in the office about the condiments in your refrigerator door.
Yeah.
And you probably have condiments like as old as some of your kids.
Yeah.
But people they think they need so much.
Yeah.
But they don't.
You can do a lot with a little. And I think even for me, I learned a lot in this book. I learned, I really, really did. I mean, and also like where I started wasn't where I ended.
Mm-hmm.
So in this book uniquely, my process of writing it was very different. I literally locked myself in a room which had 2 glass walls. I designed the chapters very crudely and boringly by like, what do most people want? So it's kind of, it's clanky. It's sort of like, it's pasta, it's chicken, it's beef, it's vegetarian. Like, so it's, but it works hard. And then I had my 5 ingredients and I started going through the chapters and the 5 ingredients and started just rattling. And I wanted to be global and I wanted to do a little chapter on noodles and, people are bored of noodles, bored of rice. Right, let's make it not boring. And I wrote the book in 3 months. Shot it in 2 weeks. And
the design's gorgeous.
The design's gorgeous, but again, it really... I learned in writing the recipes that the most important ingredient is restraint. and what not to put in. And by doing so, naturally, I was able to focus mainly on one principle. So it might be like cooking the perfect salmon. So, you know, 70% on the skin side and get it like cracklings and then flip it on the other side just for that sort of 30%. So it's flaky and juicy. And, you know, and also I was sort of breaking rules on old techniques that you're taught at college. And it's like, no, screw that. This is how you get that great. So one technique, five ingredients. And then also not every meal is complete. You know, most are, but like there's probably a third of this book that's just like, right, here's a great way to cook chicken. You know, here's a killer way to have and enjoy broccoli. And I realized that actually, you know, the conversations I could see that, you know, when our cooks and chefs write recipes, people are actually editing them as they're looking at them going, well, I ain't doing that. I ain't doing the rice. I'll do boiled potatoes. And so actually when you just do a wicked chicken dish, they're going to pair it up with whatever they want, you know.
Does that crack you up or are you just used to that now? I love reading like the comments in Epicurious. And it's like a chicken recipe and they're like, well, I only have, and they mention some random ingredient. And they're like, can I make this if I only have, you know, bananas? And you're like, just make another recipe.
People are funny. I mean, I think I go through hundreds of comments a day. My team go through everything a day. Yeah. And I think it's a little bit like when I write a recipe, four people will test it in the business and then two strangers that I don't know will cook it outside. Mm-hmm. And then I'll have to master edit all of that. But that doesn't, just because they say something doesn't mean I listen to them. It also doesn't mean that I don't. You know, I have to sort of sit back and sort of go, okay. Because perfect doesn't really exist, but my job's to get, I want a Jamie Oliver recipe to be as perfect as you can get. That's why I, you know, every recipe I write is like $2,000 in testing. So it's not a cheap practice to have. But I learned very early in my career that, you know, if someone's going out and spending 30, 40 bucks on a meal, and if it's written wrong, really they should come back to you and ask for the refund.
Or if a recipe doesn't work, they will let you know.
Oh my God, yeah. And so I would like to think that after 20, I think you can get lucky on a book once or twice. But after 20 years, I hope that the reason that I've earned trust is testing, actually.
Gotten lucky more than once or twice.
Yeah, 20 years. And I think, and also like with this book particularly, it's really nice to know that you can cast your net wide and get a wider range of people cooking again.
Mm-hmm. All right, next question. Do people ever invite you over for dinner?
Rarely. I think like 7 people in 20 years. It's pretty shocking, isn't it? It's a shame, really.
What do you hope they make when they invite you over?
I don't care. They can make cheese on toast and I'd be so happy. I'd be grateful. I mean, they could just, you know. It's funny. No, it's not funny. It's a bit sad, really.
All right. We're really curious about who some of your female mentors were over the years. We know that you worked at the River Cafe and we love Ruth. She spoke at our conference last year and has been in the magazine and she's amazing.
Yeah.
But we were curious about your time there and some others who've influenced you.
Rose Gray and Ruth Rogers are like, you know, there's no way anything good I've ever done I wouldn't have done without them. So, you know, I don't even know if they're aware of their family tree. They'll be aware of the crude family tree of Rose and Ruth's kind of genius and love and care and ability to cut through bullshit, but they really don't understand like I hear Rose and Ruthie on a daily basis in my head in a nice way, and they weren't just good because they were talented, which they are. They were good because they were cutting through the mustard. The only thing that mattered was the ingredients and the care. They did not give a flying shit about chefs and French regimental kitchens or training or stars. They absolutely, it was just about caring for great ingredients. And it was a joy to see. And it was, they were, you know, 25 years ago in the River Cafe and 20 years ago, well, I was there 23 years ago. My God, amazing, amazing. And I was at a restaurant last night, King, which,
we love King.
You know, ex-River Cafe girls, gold, you can see it. It lives on. And I think what's interesting, and I'm proud to say that even with my 15 restaurant, which by default was a charity, but we did a 14-month training program with our young people, and we trained them all the same. But like River Cafe ex chefs, they all were their own people by the end. So we weren't training chefs, we were training thinkers and cooks, and because we were changing menus every day at 15, like we did at the River Cafe, you some go in to be pizza, you know, and also there's no kind of hierarchy between a Michelin star. I have students that have graduated through me that have Michelin stars, and I don't. Mm-hmm. And so from Michelin star food to like incredible bakers, incredible, you know, the hottest place to have pasta in London right now is one of my ex-students, you know, Padella in Borough Market. He's just killing it. And do you know what I mean? So, mm-hmm. But it doesn't matter if it's a sandwich, a pizza, a posh restaurant. And I think that was Rose and Ruthie's spirit. But other female mentors, well, I think also the nice thing about mentors, I don't think it has to be physical. So, like, I was hanging off of every word of Alice Waters 25 years ago, and how can you not love her? Alice is Alice, but, you know, she's the North Star and anchor that she will always be, and she's non-compromising, brilliant. Stephanie Alexander from Australia, Patricia Wells, Marcella Hussain. There's a lot, to be honest, in my top 20 books, they'd actually all be female. And that's not because I'm sort of a feminist or ultra PC or anything like that. It's just because, generally speaking, they tend to speak from the heart, from a very maternal, I feel. So, you know, like Rose and Ruthie were like, it was like their ears and eyes were always focused on what's coming through the door. It's as a male cook myself, I had to train myself to be more like that, more feminine. And what does that mean? Well, I felt it was quite male. It was more about kind of, you get on the phone and ask for 40 racks of lamb, whereas Rose and Ruthie immediately be like, well, that's like, you know, that's like 20 sheep. So why don't you just get 2 sheep and use the whole thing? So do you know what I mean? And I was a dyslexic kid. So I was quite lucky because I couldn't read a narrative book, but I could read a recipe or a mag. So, yeah, those kind of role models are really important for me.
How'd you wind up in the kitchen at River Cafe?
I just read that first book, River Cafe Blue, and it just changed me. And not just the pictures, like the graphics as well. And I used to watch them design their books and stuff, and again, like that affected the way that I design books. So, you know, even down to back to Quick and Easy 5, you know, just in this particular book, fighting for white space. And as a dyslexic, too much fuss freaks me out. And then I think if you're a nervous cook, that's almost as bad as dyslexia, like because too much fuss freaks you out. So, fighting for white space. You know, trying to bring combos that just want to work together instead of trying to make sort of, you know, snail porridge taste great. Do you know what I mean? Like, go with the flow. Like, go fish where the fish are. Like, just the book is just, let's try and make it easy for people. Now, I was very lucky. I was working with Antonio Coluccio and Gennaro Contaldo at the time, and I did my time there, and I read that book, and I just said, I'm sorry, I have to go here. And I went for my interview, and my dad always taught me to wear a suit, but I had no money, so I just had the crappiest suit. Literally, if you'd have seen me, it was a really bad suit, but B, if you'd have put me anywhere near a candle, I would have gone up in flames. It was so cheap. But also, it's quite, if you know the River Cafe, it's quite un-River Cafe. Yeah. So I did my interview with Rose, and I got the job, and never looked back. Yeah.
What can men in positions of power like yourself do to help women in the industry with everything that's going on?
It's a really important question and a really big question. I think, in a way, it needs to go beyond that, because the problem the industry has before behavior is that women are not choosing to go into the industry. So are they connected? Maybe. Or is it just like this kind of old structure of what a week should look like, or rotas or doubles, or, you know. So all I can say is, like, I probably employ more. I'm like 4 or 5% above the average of women in the kitchen, but it's still like only 14%.
If I had a button I could press tomorrow to get to 50-50, I'd go there because it's a much better place. They function much better for all the right reasons. But the problem we really have is there's not enough women coming into the industry. So I think the industry needs to really answer that as an industry first. And then the behaviour thing is just, is not even for me about women. It's about women, men. It's about racism. It's about drug culture. It's about behaviour. And, you know, when I started in the kitchens, it was just okay to have quite... there was like fear culture. You know, fear culture is an interesting one. You know, like fear works. That's just it's proven itself to work. It's very efficient, but it's very thin. It's not deep. So fear can command efficiency fast, but it doesn't kind of build thinkers, forward thinkers. And so if you compare that back to Rose and Ruthie, of course, all of the people that graduate from that kitchen are thinkers.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for your book. Thank you for all the good energy you put out into the world.
And thank you very much.
If there's anything Cherry Bomb can do to help with 2030, you're the bomb, Jamie.
Thank you very much. I'm very grateful.
Bye.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed my chat with Jamie Oliver. Before we go, I want to share a short recording I did a few years ago with my Aunt Olive, my grandmother's sister. She passed away a few months ago at the age of 98, and she was one of the most positive and resilient people I ever met. Beyond that, she was famous in my family for having a red kitchen. Literally, everything was red, from the potholders to the stove to the refrigerator. When you're a little kid, a red kitchen seems so magical. And today, as an adult looking back on it, it still seems magical. My Aunt Olive spent the last years of her life in Alabama with her daughter and lots of grandchildren. Even though I didn't get to see her much, her optimism had a huge influence on me and gives me something to aspire to every day. Here's a snippet from a phone conversation we had a few years ago.
What did you like about having a red kitchen?
What I like about it?
Uh-huh.
I just loved the red. Yes, a red stove, red refrigerator, countertops, everything is red.
And Aunt Olive, what did you cook in the kitchen?
What did I cook?
Yeah.
I had a beautiful stove. And it had a grill in it, and it had a deep well. It was just a beautiful, and a red stove. You could put it on and then shut it off, and it would cook while you were away.
Oh, wow.
Then it would be ready when we came home. It was a wonderful stove, wonderful stove.
Did you work when you had kids?
Yeah, I worked in Wagner College, the last job I had.
So you were a working working mom?
Yeah. I worked in the Green Stamp store.
Uh-huh. Oh, you did?
Yes.
And Aunt Olive, what was your specialty in the kitchen? What was your specialty? What were you famous for making?
Pot roast. Apple pie. I could make anything.
Thank you to my Aunt Olive. Rest in peace, and I hope there's a big red kitchen in heaven. That's it for today's show. A big thank you to Jamie Oliver for taking the time to speak with us. Be sure to check out his new book, 5 Ingredients, Quick and Easy Cooking. Thank you to our sponsor, Hansenbrook Farm Organic Pasture-Raised Eggs, for supporting this season of Radio Cherry Bomb. Special thanks to our associate producer and our very own Riot Girl, Jess Seidman. And thank you to the band Tra La La for our theme song. Radio Cherry Bomb is a joint production of Cherry Bomb Magazine and the Heritage Radio Network. Thanks for listening, everyone. You're the bomb.
I'll have what she's having.